So, I thought we'd just start by asking, what was your goal with the story of stuff?
With the film or the book, or just the whole
With
thing?
the overall project and with, I guess, with the film initially.
I have to say that my goal, it was so different than what actually happened. When I was making the story of stuff, I was not actually trying to make something that would be popularly popular. That would be sort of popularly, actually popular, period. When I was writing my funding proposals to get the money for it, we wrote that if 50,000 people watched it, we would consider that success. And we literally got that the first day. I mean, we were absolutely floored by the response. I'll tell you the background to the story stuff because I think it's very interesting, sort of about communications and for activists. Is I have been working on these issues for 20 years, and I have visited, literally hundreds of factories where our stuff is made in dumps, where our stuff is dumped, all over the world. And so I've seen firsthand the hidden environmental and social and health costs of all this stuff in our lives. And I'm really obsessed with garbage. Like, I just think it's fascinating. And I guess I'm a little too obsessed because I've done almost nothing else for 20 years but study this stuff. And so I was so deep in it that I lost perspective. So I did this really amazing year-long leadership training program. It's called Rockwood. It's a really fabulous training program for people who want to make change in their lives, social change. And so there's 20 people in this program. We met four times over the course of the year, and it was very experienced and very diverse activists from all over the issue spectrum. And so in this training program, excuse me, we practiced giving a talk about what our purpose is in life in front of the crowd, and we gave each other permission to give us authentic feedback about how it came off. And it was really a incredibly important opportunity for me because I had been talking about this stuff for years, but I hadn't realized how I had gotten so deep into it that I w wasn't able to talk about it with normal people anymore. That I was too full of jargon and too technically precise and just too deep into it. So I had lost my ability to communicate. But furthermore, because I had traveled so much internationally and seen this stuff firsthand, I saw the connections between so many different issues. So, women's health and excessive commercialization of public life and international trade institutions and all these things. If you travel internationally, you really see how these things are so connected. So when I said I worked on garbage, I meant I worked on all these things because I saw garbage as a door to all these broader issues. But I realized not everybody understood that. They thought I was like some weird girl from Berkeley who was obsessed with garbage. So I stood up in front of this crowd and gave my presentation and said that my purpose in life was to bring about a paradigm shift in our relationship to materials. And I explained how we use too much materials and we use too toxic materials. And I was trying to sound as credible as possible. So I had tons of technical terms and parts per million and all this stuff. And I gave my talk very confidently. I'd been saying it for 20 years. And I am so grateful that some people in the crowd, one person raised their hand and said, "I have no idea what you're talking about." And there was a hand signal you were supposed to do if you agreed. And I was stunned. Like, the whole room said they couldn't understand what I was talking about. And they gave me this amazing feedback. They said that I was starting the conversation 20 years into it. They said, "We haven't been going to factories and dumps for 20 years, so we don't even know what you're talking about when you talk about materials." They also said that I didn't provide any entree points for them with their issues, which was so interesting to me because when I say I'm fighting garbage, that means I'm fighting racism, I'm fighting sexism, I'm fighting neoliberal economic models, I'm fighting a consumer-oriented culture. All those things are so inherent in it, but I realized I wasn't explaining the connections between the issues well enough. And so I'm so grateful. These people told me my talk was uninspiring and inaccessible. They said, "We couldn't figure out what you were talking about." They said, "It's very clear you know." They said I was very good at showing off how much I knew, but they said it was just no place for them to plug in. So they challenged me to come up with a way to talk about these issues that provides entree points for people to enter. And so what I did is I used this group of 20 activists that I met with over the course of the year to practice different ways of talking about it. And my real goal was so that all these people, there was, somebody who works on democracy and civic engagement, somebody who works on poverty and economic justice, somebody who works on environmental justice in Asian American communities. I wanted all these people to see that we're not going to win by working on a sort of laundry list of issues, but that all of these issues are connected and there's a deeper systemic driver, so that we could break out of our silos and work as one cohesive movement rather than a laundry list of campaigns. So really, when I was making this film, I was writing it for my fellow activists. I wanted the people that are working on recycling and forest preservations and gender equity and all these issues to see it's all part of the same system. And in fact, when I was writing it, for example, one Free Range Studios who made the film, they said, you probably should take out You Suck because then it won't be shown in schools. And I said, this film isn't going to be shown in schools. Like, I had no idea it would be popular. I really thought I was writing it for my fellow activists, like the people in this training, who I felt like weren't getting the interconnections of all these issues. And I wanted us to move from what I call transactional politics to transformative politics. Rather than saving one forest or stopping one factory, can we really begin to challenge the underlying drivers of the whole system? Sorry, that was a long answer. But I just thought it was so interesting to me because I am such an expert on waste, you know, and I was so proud of myself standing up there. It was so interesting to me when people said, we have no idea what you're talking about and it's boring and inaccessible. I was like, what? You know, I'm so glad someone told me that.
So when was this Rockwood training and where was that?
About,
I'm just trying to get the timeline here.
Oh, so you know that it was actually a while ago because it was 2005, and so what happened is that's where they first told me that my talk sucked basically, and I'm so glad that they said things like, "You're starting the conversation 20 years into it." I thought that was so important. It reminded me of that Saul Alinsky famous quote about talk to people where they're at, not where you're at. So then there's four times over the year we met, and it was a great experience. Everybody used that really safe space to experiment with very different ways about talking about our work. And so I would try to be more accessible and more accessible, and each time they said, you know, it's a little bit better, but they said I'm still too wonky and technical. And they finally, on the third time, they said, you know, we give up on you. They said, you are never going to be able to figure out a way to talk about this, that other people are going to want to hear it. So on the last of the four sessions, like almost as a joke, I took this huge piece of butcher paper and put it on the wall because they kept saying, start at the beginning. And so I said, I'm going to start at the beginning. This is extraction. And I just went through the whole thing off the top of my head. And I was sort of joking because they kept saying, start at the beginning, and they loved it. And they actually, like, some of them ran up and hugged me and said, you know, you finally learned how to talk about what you're doing. And so there was a woman who worked with the Tides Foundation. She said, I want to capture this talk and put it on my webpage. You need to make a movie out of this. And I said, who's going to watch a movie of me talking about garbage? I said, no one's going to watch that. And so I kept doing my work. And she kept reminding me. Every few months, she'd call me up and say, have you started making that movie? Have you started making that movie? And meanwhile, some of the people there who liked the live version of the story of stuff so much, they asked me to give it the talk at other conferences and other conferences. And pretty soon, I was traveling around the country doing this talk, which had evolved into like a 45-minute, it's sort of like part comedy routine, part technical lecture, but it's a really funny, engaging 45-minute talk about all these issues. And I was stunned how much people liked it. And that's really how I was able to fine-tune the script so much, is I gave the talk dozens and dozens of times. And every time I would give the talk, someone would say, do you have a film of this? And I just kept thinking, no one's going to watch a film of me. You know, this whole story is like a list of my bad judgment. I was like, no one's going to watch a film of me talking about this. So finally, I was so sick of giving this talk. I said, if I give this talk one more time, I'm going to throw up. Like, I still give it occasionally, and about 10 minutes into it, it's like a quarter of the way through, I think, oh, my God, I can't give this goddamn talk again. And so finally, I said, let's make a movie. I can't. As people started calling me and asking me to give it at conferences and schools, I just can't be flying around the country doing this. So I had collected all the names of those people over the years who said they'd like a movie of it, and I wrote to them all and said, okay, I want to make a movie. Will you help? And so many people pitched in money. So my friend filmed me giving the talk live at a conference, a 45-minute film, and we took it to Free Range Studios, and we said, how might one capture this online? And they came up with a whole bunch of different options, and then all these people pitched in money, and then we made the film. And, you know, literally we had no idea that it was going to be such a hit. So we launched it in December 2007. I think a big reason it was such a big hit, I think, is that it was right before, you know, the consumer shopping Christmas frenzy when everyone feels so, like, know, stuff saturated. And then it just stunned us, the response. And so it so far had over 8 million views.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things that surprised me also about the response is that we had to leave out the international part. The live talk is 45 minutes to an hour and has a lot more international stuff. And we just couldn't fit it into the film. We thought 20 minutes was even pushing it with how long people will sit and stare at a screen. And we didn't have money to make a longer film anyway. And so we just finally cut out the international stuff. And I said, you know, the problem is greatest in the northern countries. We'll just really focus on especially the U.S., and maybe we'll do an international one later. But according to Google Analytics, it's been viewed in 223 countries and territories. And we have massive responses on email from people all over Asia, Latin America, like really all over the world.
That's great.
Yeah, that was another big surprise.
Yeah.
The whole thing was a surprise. You know, I feel like that we took the temperature of the public without realizing it and found that a lot of people out there share our concern about the orientation of our society and want to live differently. Like, we have literally gotten hundreds of thousands of emails from people who say, yes, you know, I knew that, I just didn't know how to say it. You know, or yes, I totally agree, what can we do? Like, it's been so inspiring in terms of the state of the movement.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was not just, it was the, you know, it was the right message, but I think it was also the right format very much too. I think that, you know, kind of like you said, you know, people were working on these issues are in such a wonky state, and it was just very fresh to see something in an explicitly accessible format, you know, that was really going for that. And I guess I was curious, after you started talking with Redbird Studios, is that what it's called?
Redbird something else.
After you were talking to Free Range, how did you ultimately settle on the format with the, you know, you in front of the drawings?
Well, that's what the live talk is. You know, the live talk is a big, I have like an 8-foot-long thing of butcher paper behind me, and I start to talk with those icons of extraction, production, distribution, consumption, disposal, and then I fill in all that stuff, all the drawings. I just fill it in as I go, not as cutely as Free Range did, but similar. And so when Free Range looked at the film of me doing it, we thought of a whole bunch of different ways to do it. We said it could be 100% animated. It could be, we could turn my scribbly drawings into a PowerPoint and make it like Al Gore's movie. Like, you know, we talked about a whole bunch of different things. And I just think Free Range, they are just creative geniuses. And for example, I'm kind of shy about all the attention, so I said, let's make it entirely animated so I don't have to be in it. And they said, absolutely not. Like, I'm so glad that I listened to them. They said, absolutely not. They said that having a real person makes it so much more accessible and trustworthy and all this. I said, let's have real photographs of smokestacks and starving people and all this. And they said, absolutely not. They said, everybody knows what that looks like. And they said that we're so overwhelmed with images of disaster and crisis and poverty and all this that they felt that when those images came on the screen, a part of the viewer shuts down out of depression or overwhelm or crisis fatigue. And so they said, let's try to get the same images across, but in a refreshing, inviting way that keeps the person sort of psychologically and emotionally open to hearing the information. And I think that really works because the information's pretty harsh. If I was giving that pretty harsh information along with pictures of starving children, people would shut down in some ways.
Interesting. That's an interesting way to look at it for sure. I'm assuming you're familiar probably with the Beehive Design Collective too. Are you familiar with that
Which
group?
Collective?
The Beehive Design Collective, they do.
Oh, yeah.
Giant,
yeah, I know those guys. They're great.
Room. Yeah, I mean, some of their stuff is pretty dark in a way that probably, I think your film wasn't, but...
you know, it was a risk, you know, because we thought, will it be considered too frivolous to have these cute things? You know, it was a bit of a risk.
Interesting. How did you initially get into activism? I mean, you talked a little bit about, you know, the focus on, that you've really been focused on the issues of garbage and consumerism for a long time, but how did you initially get into it, I guess, back 20 years ago?
Well, you know, I grew up in Seattle, which is a pretty environmentally aware city, and sort of it was, you know, in the 70s when schools had recycling drives and, you know, the sort of environmental consciousness was just beginning to really take root, and especially in the Pacific Northwest. So caring about the environment was such a part of our air at that point, and, you know, growing up in Seattle. So I had that early sense of environmental responsibility. But I think a couple things really made a difference. One is that my mother, you know, we were not rich. I had a single mother who had three kids. And she raised us to have a sense of appreciation and respect for the stuff that we had. So there wasn't a lot of superfluous consumption going on in our house. There wasn't, we didn't chuck stuff because it was out of style. We brought our bikes in from the rain. I was just raised with a real sense of respect for the stuff that we had and appreciation for it. And, you know, while we weren't poor, she was very poor growing up. And so she especially just made us realize how fortunate we were. And, you know, by today's standards, we still had so little stuff compared to the average household today. But growing up with that sort of sense of awareness and appreciation for stuff, I then ended up going to college in New York. And I lived on the Upper West Side, and I would walk up Broadway. My dorm was on 110th Street, and my classes were on 116th Street. And I'd walk up those blocks every day, every morning, and it was stunning to me to see literally shoulder-high piles of garbage the entire way, the six blocks. And, you know, in Seattle, we don't have shoulder-high piles of garbage. Like, we really try to reduce our waste there. And so I got so curious about what was in this stuff, and I started digging around in it and saw how much it was paper, and, you know, easily preventable and recyclable waste. So I was just got curious. I was like, what's going on here? And I said, where is that stuff going afterwards? And so I took a field trip to the landfill, which is something I really recommend everybody goes and visits their landfill. It is such a fascinating thing and such an important part of our overall society that usually we really keep hidden out of sight. So I went to the landfill in New York, which at that point was Freshkills Landfill on Staten Island. It's one of the biggest dumps in the world. A lot of people say that along with the Great Wall of China, it's one of two man-made structures you can see from space. It's just gigantic. And I stood there as a sophomore in college and looked out in every direction. Like, if you imagine, literally as far as you can see in every direction, there were, you know, appliances and furniture and clothes and shoes and books. And I was, you know, coming from this place where you have reverence and appreciation for your stuff, to see this massive scale, I mean, just absolute gigantic scale of destruction and waste, just really struck me in terms of it being wrong. I just thought, oh, my God, our economy is based on this one-way flow of resources, from resources to trash. And not only is that unsustainable, you know, how can you do that forever, but also it's being hidden from view. I became fascinated about how is this happening? Why do the people who know let it happen? And how come so many people don't know? So I just sort of got on this path for 20 years to try to figure it out and to communicate it. So weird. I go off to this school and come back like obsessed with garbage.
Sure. Yeah. Well, everybody's got their, you know, we all have our different ways of, I think, you know, the sort of big moments, you know, that really did it for us, I think.
I still think looking at garbage is such an important way to learn about what's happening in a society. So, you know, whenever I go to a new country, the first thing I do is start digging through the garbage on the streets and go to visit the dump, because it's kind of like reading a community's secret diary. You know, you can find out so many things about what's happening in a society by looking at the garbage.
Before we keep going to it, I just wanted to also just do a quick time check. I'm not sure if you have any other, like, imminent appointments or anything like that, too, just to see how many questions we can get in for this.
I'm gonna see. You can tell me to make shorter answers, too.
No. The answers are great. I want to make sure I have time to get to...
My next interview is at 11:30, so we're cool.
Okay, sounds good. Do you have a favorite or most interesting item of garbage that you found in these explorations?
Oh, my gosh, I have so much stuff. I do have a jar of this incinerator ash on my desk that has a good story. The city of Philadelphia for years was burning its garbage in a municipal waste incinerator, which is the dumbest thing you can do if you have a bunch of garbage. And one of the reasons it's so dumb is it creates this ash that is full of toxic chemicals. and you have to figure out what to do with it. And it's so stupid because you're turning like normal garbage into this hazardous waste. But anyway, Philadelphia did this for years, and they had this huge pile of this ash piled up on a lot next to their incinerator. They wanted to get rid of it, so they hired these schmuckos, companies, and the companies put it on a ship and sailed around the world to dump it on a third world country. And I ended up tracking them, and we would alert every, we hired Lloyd's of London, who would track ships, and every country that it was nearing, we would send an emergency warning to the government and say, warning, the ship is coming with toxic waste. And at one point during the ship, they ended up sailing 27 months, and they went to every continent except Antarctica, and twice during the journey, they got a paint job and changed the ship's name, but we still tracked them. And at one point, they went to Haiti, and they lied and said that this stuff was fertilizer, and they got an import permit for fertilizer, and they dumped 4,000 tons of this heavy metal and dioxin-contaminated ash on the beach in Haiti. And Haiti's constitution even prohibits waste imports, but they just did it anyway. And so we notified the Haitian government, and when the Haitian government learned it wasn't fertilizer, they said, stop unloading it, load this stuff back up and leave. And the ship just left in the middle of the night.
Oh.
And so that ash sat there, and to me it was an incredibly powerful symbol of how the U.S. has treated Haiti as a garbage pit for years, I mean, for centuries. And so it became sort of a mission of mine to get that ash home, because I just thought it is so wrong for the richest country in the world to dump its toxic waste on the poorest country in the hemisphere. And so I went to Haiti a bunch of times over the years to get this ash home, and I do have a little jar of that ash on my desk as a reminder of the incredible international campaign that developed around that of people promoting justice. Even people from Philadelphia got really involved and said, bring the ash home. You know, usually people are saying NIMBY, not in my backyard. I don't know if you've heard this expression, but a lot of waste activists are sort of classified as NIMBYs, of not in my backyard, like somewhere but not in my backyard. And there's an evolving movement within the environmental justice and within the sort of waste activist world where instead of NIMBY, people are saying, nope, not on planet Earth. If it's too dangerous for me and my kids, then it's too dangerous for Haitians and Haitian kids. So this group of Philadelphians actually went to Haiti and had a protest in front of the American embassy there and said, bring the ash home. It's not okay to use Haiti as a dumping ground. So that was one of my favorite cases because of how well people worked together. And we did finally get the ash to come back to Pennsylvania.
Great. It's a good story. So I'm curious, how did you end up deciding to focus on cap and trade as your sort of, I mean, it seemed to be the first priority as a follow-up story. Two story of stuff. I think you know, a lot of people maybe were surprised by that.
Yeah, well, it actually wasn't even our next in line. It's amazing. I get about 5 requests a week to make a story of something, and I just can't make them all. And so, plus I was so busy for that year writing this book. But my colleagues here and I, we really brainstormed, and Free Range Studios, we continue to partner with them. We brainstormed what the criteria were for moving forward with the films. And a couple of the criteria we had is that we feel like this technique that we've developed is very good at breaking down complicated issues to make them accessible. So we wanted to pick issues that are complicated and explain them in an accessible way. One of the things we strive for is being accessible without dumbing it down. Like, we're not cutting corners on any of the issues, but we just want to make it accessible. Another criteria we had is issues that are not adequately in the public discourse. There's a lot of issues, problems out there that are intimidating or to talk about. Or sometimes I realize that environmentalists, when we talk about these issues, in order to prove our credibility, like I did at that Rockwood training, in order to improve our credibility, we use the biggest technical words we can find and show off how smart we are. And while it might show that we know this stuff, it ends up excluding other people from the conversation. And a lot of the activists I've worked with in the Global South have said to me they feel like the climate discussions are a train that is speeding along so fast that they want to jump in, but they just don't know how to start because it's so complicated and technical. And so we were not planning on doing one about cap and trade, but some activists from around the world who I knew from doing broader environmental justice work came to me and they said, it's an emergency. They said a bunch of corporate-oriented, I mean, companies and corporate-oriented environmental groups are pushing forward this legislation that does not meet the science, that benefits big corporate polluters more than people, that completely ignores the issue of international equity in terms of climate impacts. And they said that the demand for climate justice and the really rigid critiques of rigorous critiques of cap and trade were being excluded from the conversation. So they asked for our help to use the Story of Stuff platform to simplify and raise this issue into the public discourse. And it was such a compelling case about how this was so critically important. The timing was so important. The issue is so important. And the really more conservative mainstream NGOs were dominating the discourse so much that these millions of people, especially in third world countries, were feeling like their voices weren't being heard. And, you know, we even saw that in the response to the film. We knew that when we made the film, some of the big, powerful environmental groups would get mad at us, which they did. But one of the things I thought was so patronizing was some of the critiques said, oh, well, you know, this is an 11th hour raising of these issues, whereas people in third world countries have been raising these issues for years and have been totally ignored. So it was really disingenuous for people to say, oh, this last-minute raising of these issues, as though it only counts if a white person says it. You know, I just thought it was outrageous.
Yeah. Do you feel like it, I mean, how have you taken some of the flack that you've gotten? The Story of Stuff was has been really widely praised in the environmental movement. Has it been hard to not have, I mean, obviously some people have been very happy with this, but some people have not. Has that been hard at all?
Yeah, it's funny. Like TerraPass, these carbon offsetters, they issued this press release that says, "Why does Annie Leonard hate the environment?" It's a story.
Oh, wow.
Before we made the film, we did a real clear analysis of who we would anger and who would appreciate it. And it's pretty much the response lined up right along with what we expected. And so, you know, I told one activist from India, I said, you know, we have 8 million viewers. I said, if we launch this film, I might lose 2 million of them. You know, I'm just guessing how many people are going to stop liking me. And he said, yeah, but the remaining ones will like you even more, because they said, you're saying what needs to be said. And for every complaint that we got 100 thank you for raising these issues. I mean, from all over. And there was one set of responses that did make me sad. Before I made the film, I called up a lot of people I knew that worked on climate issues, and I asked them, what do you think about cap and trade? And almost across the board, people said, cap and trade will not work. It doesn't match the science. It disproportionately benefits corporations. Like, absolutely, people know this. But what they said is, it's the best we can get. And as a matter of fact, after the film came out, there was an email listserv of environmental law professors, and someone sent me this string of conversations on it. Somebody had posted the Story of Cap and Trade, and this one environmental law professor wrote back and said it was irresponsible of Annie to release this. And he said, it's true that the cap and trade legislation, I forget the exact words, but he said something like, the cap and trade legislation is barely better than terrible, but it's the best we're going to get, so we have to rally around it. And what I felt like is, I'm done rallying around, you know, a little bit better than terrible. Like, I want us to aim much higher. And so to get back to the one set of responses that made me sad were the many, like, Washington, D.C. environmentalists who called me or emailed me and said, I'm so glad you said it. It's the truth, but I can't say it. Like, environmentalist called me up, a very well-known environmentalist called me while I was making the film and said, I heard you're making a film about cap and trade. I said, yeah, I am. And he asked me, is it critical or is it supportive? And I said, it's critical. And he said, God bless you. I said, oh, I'm so glad you appreciate that. I said, great. Well, we're getting ready for the launch, and there's 200 organizations around the world that are going to put it on their webpage on the day of the launch. Can I add your group? He said, no, you can't do that. He said, I can't risk alienating the Sierra Club. And I was like, oh. So the thing that made me sad are the people who knew that the critique was correct, who knew that cap and trade is not going to bring us anywhere near the level of solution we need, but who are afraid to speak up. I feel like we've lost our sense of political imagination in this country. You know, and I thought of all the heroes that I have, you know, throughout history. None of them would have rallied around something that was a little bit better than terrible. So that was the part that made me sad.
So you just got back from, I saw Googling around a little bit, from a conference on feminism and climate change at Bernard, I think.
You know, I did not speak at that. It's so funny. They asked me to do that months ago, and I said I can't do it because it's right before my book tour.
Oh, and they put you on anyways.
Yeah, and then a couple of people emailed me and said, I heard you're coming, and I said, I'm not coming. And I even emailed them and said, I told them no months ago, so I don't know what that was about. It looked like a great
that
conference, but I just couldn't make it.
Well, pretend you had gone. what are your thoughts on the connection between these issues, between climate change and feminism?
There are so many connections on pretty much on every angle at which you want to approach this issue. In terms of the drivers of climate change, which are, you know, also the drivers of just sort of general environmental deterioration, I also think they're a lot of the drivers of patriarchy and sexism. There's this very sort of patriarchal arrogance of superiority and control that permeates our industrial society. And whether it's the domination of women or the domination of children or the domination of the planet, just the incredible arrogance that blinds us to the sort of suicidal nature of that approach is very similar, whether it's talking about, you know, the climate or the planet or women. I also really see in the responses to environmental destruction and climate change, you can really see the obstacle of sexism throughout. Like, for example, the story of Cap and Trade, there were so many of the critics that were complaining with my points, rather than really responding to the points that I made, took this very patronizing approach of, Annie doesn't understand politics. You know, it's just like in the environmental movement when poor people or people of color or women critique something and the dominant crowd says, oh, they don't understand politics. I don't think that they would be so quick to write it off if I was a man. I might be wrong, but
yeah.
I don't think so. I think it's a very patronizing, superior attitude. And to have these, you know, big, well-funded, corporate-friendly NGOs try to dismiss what I have to say because, you know, poor little Annie doesn't understand politics, as opposed to, I disagree. You know, the root of disagreement is not always a lack of understanding. Sometimes you just disagree.
Yeah. How do you think we overcome that? You know, sort of both the, you know, the, I guess kind of what you were talking about before, the sort of lack of imagination on solutions to these issues and the sort of, you know, entrenched patriarchy, the entrenched anti-environmentalism, these forces. What do you think is our broader social change strategy?
Well,
obviously a big question to outline in a short interview, but
I can tell a little bit. One thing is, I think we need to shed our fear of being considered unreasonable. Now, in the story of Cap and Trade, I saw so many people who were afraid to publicly agree, even though they privately did, because they didn't want to appear unreasonable. I feel like a lot of environmentalists are still stuck in trying to choose between different items on a menu that someone else has set. And the real power is not choosing between items on a menu, but deciding what's on that menu. And we're too quick to give away our power. So, you know, we're willing to sort of grovel at whatever little crumbs we can get from the current political process, or we're willing to choose between the lesser of two evils. And we've got to get a critical mass of people that say, no, I reject that whole paradigm. I reject the whole menu. You know, I would love to somehow reignite the kind of courage and willingness to go against the grain that we saw in our political leaders throughout history. When I lived in Washington, D.C., I remember how much people were scared to do stuff that would limit their access to Capitol Hill. One time when I was working at Greenpeace, I did something that really pissed off a couple of congressmen. And the congressman told me that they were going to call every environmental group and tell them not to work with me anymore. And so I was calling the environmental group to say, heads up, pissed off this congressman, this is what happened, just to let them know. And I was saying, if they call you and you have any questions about it, please call me so I can tell you my side of the story. And I remember I called one of these Washington, D.C. groups, and they said, okay, well, your first priority has got to be to repair your relationship with this congressmember. And I said, are you kidding? That's not even on my list. Like, who? Why are we so quick to give away our power and accept whatever little crumbs the dominant system offers us? So I just think we need to really support the people who stand up and take the risks and join them and do it ourselves.
Yeah. So on, I guess on a positive note on that front, in a sense, you've actually yourself become sort of a little bit of a celebrity of sorts within the movement. And I'm wondering, and you know, you've said that you were surprised that the video's become so popular. But what do you think that what do you see both as your role within the social change movement as sort of, you know, a well-known figure at this point? And also, what do you see what do you think of this generally, of this sort of the nature of celebrity, I guess, in social change? Do you think, what are your thoughts?
Well, you know, this is really new to me. I'm still used to the old reality where I would be like chasing people down to try to get them to talk to me about garbage for 5 minutes. And so the fact that I have way more phone calls and emails than I can possibly answer to talk about this is, it's taking me a while to get used to understanding that this, you know, the new situation. So I have a few thoughts about it. One thing is, I really believe that celebrity or being in the spotlight or attention or any validation, any of those things in the abstract are useless. It's what we do with those things that makes a difference. I cannot tell you how many people have written to me, and I appreciate this, and they're like, congratulations. And I said, getting 8 million people to watch a movie, that doesn't deserve congratulations. It's how I can leverage this platform that I now have. That will determine whether or not I deserve congratulations. So I really think, I say, God, it'd be so much easier if I was just like Julia Roberts and just wanted to be famous, or Miley Cyrus or something, but I don't. I want to, you know, encourage people to take action, and I want to redesign our economy so that we can live in a way that's sustainable and fair. And that's just a lot harder than just trying to be famous. So let's see how I can leverage this for change before anybody gives me any congratulations. I lost my train of thought. There's something else I was going to say about it. I forgot. I'll go to the next. Maybe it'll come back.
Sure. Well, sort of on a related note, the right wing, which is seeming at least to be somewhat resurgent at the moment, at least in the way the media is covering it, has gone after you a bit, in part because of, you know, this celebrity, I think.
Oh.
And
I
guess
I
both on a positive and a negative. Go ahead.
About the celebrity thing that I think is important. I have a small group of people that I work with here, and we have a great advisory board of people who are really experts in these issues to help us figure out what to do. It's an interesting situation to be in because I'm in a place right now where a lot of people like the story of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like I could stay in this sort of safe arena and just keep talking about these issues that everybody agrees on. And I was telling my board, I said I would be guaranteed to be invited to cocktail parties and everything would be fine. I said, or we can use this platform and the connection we have with these 8 million people to push the discussion further, to begin to broaden the space of political discourse, like we did with Story of Cap and Trade. And we said, you know, we will lose some of our supporters. We will take risks and maybe people will stop liking the Story of Stuff project and maybe we will stop getting funding and maybe, you know, this wave will lose its momentum. And I was so happy. Our entire board and staff, everybody agreed, let's take that risk. Let's, rather than trying to hold on to, you know, I don't really know if celebrity is the right word, but rather than hold on to the spotlight that we've gotten and stay here where it's comfortable and it's glow, let's push the envelope and see how far we can take the discourse. And I think that's a really important role because there's a lot of really good work and critical analysis that's happening that is not reaching the mainstream because maybe the language is off-putting or, you know, for all different reasons, it's not reaching them. if there's a way that we can use this spotlight to bridge that, that'd be really exciting, you know, to get people, get more people than are already doing so to think critically about our economy. That'd be great.
Yeah. And how about the negative attention, you know, the Lou Dobbs and the Glenn Beck, and has that bothered you? Has it been rough? Have you been getting threatened?
It doesn't
things
really
at all?
Bother me personally, because I know that, you know, that's Glenn Beck's job to do what he does. It's not really about me. That's what he does. What bothers me is the low level of political discourse in among a big part of our country, the lack of critical thinking. You know, for example, after Glenn Beck attacked us for a week, we got lots of emails of people who said things like, if you don't like stuff, why don't you move to a mud hut in Afghanistan? And I just thought, the low level of critical thinking and the low bar in public discourse worries me about the future of our country, because we got some really serious issues to discuss. And if me pointing out that there are, you know, neurotoxins in our consumer products and that workers and communities are being harmed in the way and all the things that I point out in this sort of stuff, if that leads people to say, like, I got all these emails saying, why don't you move to Russia? Why don't you move to China? It's like, that's just not an impressive level of political discourse.
Yeah.
So it worries me more about the future of this country and what happened to that vibrant civic engagement that we once had.
Do you think that it's possible that, I mean, we just saw in a strange sort of way, this movie Avatar came out, and there's been other things that have been, you know, larger, well, probably not larger, but also smaller, that have been in some ways trying to get some somewhat progressive, if maybe not necessarily the best messages out there. Do you think that there's a role for pop culture, for movies, for TV shows, for to have a positive impact in changing these things and changing the way the economy is structured and changing our relationship to the environment?
I think this is an all-hands-on-deck situation. We have to do every possible thing we can do. I mean, we definitely, there's a role for social media, for pop culture, for celebrities. Definitely there's a role for all of those to perpetuate new cultural norms that are more focused around ecological sustainability and social equity. Absolutely, we need to be, you know, changing the policies and laws. We need to be holding corporations accountable. We need to be injecting this stuff into public education. You know, this is literally an all hands on deck situation. We got to do everything we possibly can.
But, you see anything else good?
Look
anything?
At pop culture has done so much to perpetuate the over commercialization of our society, and really to stoke that the over identification with ourselves as consumers. That definitely pop culture should help rectify that situation.
Mm-hmm. Do you see anything good out there? Is there anything that that you like that's been positive?
You know, there's a lot of cool stuff on the internet that I think is helping to get people to think differently. I'm a little bit of a square, I guess, because I don't have a TV. So because of that, I'm missing a lot of what's happening in pop culture. I used to have a TV, and I found that actually, I still have the actual physical TV. I just don't have that box to watch it. So my daughter and I watch videos sometimes. But I just found that television made me feel yucky. And so I thought, why have some box in my house that's beaming messages to me to make me feel yucky? So I got rid of it. I'm so much happier. So I am somewhat out of pop culture. That's why I'm surrounded by much people much hipper than I, so that they can explain to me the cultural cues that I'm missing. So I'm so busy all day. By the time I go to bed, I'm exhausted at night. I'm like, how does the average American fit 4 hours of watching television in their day? I just don't know how they do it.
So you're working on a book version of Storystuffer. It's probably done, yeah?
It's done, yeah. It's out now. It's coming out on March 9th.
Okay, yeah. I knew it was coming out this spring. I wasn't sure the exact date. So so what's next for you, and what's different in the book? What do you get with the book?
The book is different on a few things, four things, actually. One is it has just a lot more information. Like, I rushed through everything in that film. It's so funny. The number one complaint I get about the Spur of Stuff film is people say, you left something out. I mean, I cannot tell you the thousands of emails I've got about that, to which case I say, duh, it's a 20-minute cartoon. You know, of course I left something out. I left a lot of stuff out. So the book explains a lot more of what I left out. Like in the film, when I say trashing the planet, I, like, I explain that in much more detail. There's more depth. There's more signs of hope and examples of how people are doing things differently. Throughout the book, I have this little cartoon of the little cartoon Annie with a sign that says hope, and you can flip through the book and see that all over, and it lists signs of hope of people resisting and doing things differently. Because one of the things is that I really feel, in spite of how serious all the data is about the planet, like if you look at the data about the planet, it's really bad. You know, many of the ecological systems on which life depends are really at the brink of collapse. So it's not looking good. But I still remain so hopeful because there are people all over the world who are charting a different path. So I have lots of examples of that. I also include examples of things that we could do to make a difference. So people who want to influence these issues, there's lots of ideas about what to do. And then the fourth thing it includes is a lot of personal stories. I mean, I really did spend 20 years going around the world looking at factories and dumps. So I talk about meeting garment factory workers in Haiti and meeting survivors of the Bhopal gas disaster in India. I share a lot of sort of personal stories and my own learning along the way. You know, when I started this, I was, you know, a 20-year-old interested in garbage. And through my travels around the world, I really saw that all these issues are interconnected. And garbage is not the problem, but an entire economic model that is willing to sacrifice the planet and so many people. That's the model. That's the problem, not just garbage.
And what's next after that?
The book tour starts on Monday, and I'm traveling around the country. The list of locations are on the Story of Stuff website, so if anybody wants to meet me and talk more about this in person, it'd be great if they want to come to one of the book readings. They're really all over the country. Then we have a bunch more films coming up. The next one that comes out is about manufactured demand, and it's specifically about bottled water, the story of bottled water, how companies manufacture demand and get us to buy stuff that we don't need or want. Then we have another one coming out about electronics and the story of planned obsolescence. Like, why is it that all of these things are loaded with toxics and break so quickly? Then we have a bunch more coming up in the next year, some really good ones. I won't tell you because it'll be a surprise, but we have three more stories coming out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so when
do we get to?
Well, the story of bottled water is the next one. It comes out March 22nd. But if you go to the Story of Stuff website, it's no longer just housing the Story of Stuff. It's going to house all of them. It's like a story channel now. So you can watch all the stories of. And we'll just keep making them as long as it works. Now, at some point, people will tire of just watching me rant about stuff in front of some stick figures. But as long as it works, we'll just keep making them.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen anytime soon. I don't think it will.
Well, thank you so much. I hope it doesn't. One of the things that we're doing is making sure that all the different pieces really are part of the overall conversation. So it won't be a list of, you know, 10 things that I'm ranting about. It'll be each film will take us deeper into the conversation. So, yeah, I'm excited about it. The Story of Bottled Water is great. It comes out March 22nd.
Great. Well, we'll be looking forward to it. Well, thanks so much, Annie.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your help spreading the word. And, you know, if you want a review copy of the book, you can get one from the the publisher is Free Press.
Uh-huh.
They're part of Simon & Schuster. And you have to email this guy, Andrew Dodds. It's just andrew.dodds at simonandschuster.com. And just ask for a review copy, and he'll send you one.
Did you say Andrew Dodds? D-O-D-D-S or or just
like
Andrew Dodds?
D-O-D-D-S.
Okay, so there's no period in there.
It's Andrew dot Dodds.
Oh, Andrew dot Dodds. Okay, so there is a period in there.
Andrew.
Okay.
Andrew, period, D-O-D-D-S.
Gotcha.
At simonandschuster.com.
Okay, great.
And just say you're going to run an article and you want a review copy and they'll send you one.
Uh-huh. Great. And, assuming things go well, this would be something that would be potentially out for publication in the next issue of Bitch, which comes out in about
March 9th, so that's perfect.
Yeah, the issue doesn't come out for about 2 months, but
okay.
It should be out then, and we'll probably there's a decent chance we'll have something in our podcast or website too.
Well, thank you so much. Call me back if you have any other questions.
Great. Thanks so much, Annie. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye.